drink. What is it? Is it juice? Is it this? I don't like this. I don't like that. The Prophet said, make it easy. Make it loving. Make it caring. If he invites you, sit and eat. Don't ask about what type of food and meal it is. Don't ask about what type of water or drink it is. Because sometimes we have a, you know, a specific taste like, oh, I don't like meat. I don't like this. I don't like that. The least we can do to make our brothers in faith happy is to first accept their invitation, and second, to not ask, because it's rude to ask. Because sometimes when I say come in and I'm making, for example, I have chicken, and you have a problem with chicken, you don't like eating chicken. Now, if you say to me, I don't want to eat chicken, that puts me in a very bad position because I think, okay, he doesn't eat chicken, then what should I do? And then I feel like, you know, anxious, and all these feelings go rush through my head. So you put me in a bad situation. We shouldn't do that to people. If they come, if they say come sit and eat, we should just eat. Don't question it. I mean, even pretend to eat. Even if you don't like it, eat it for the sake of your brother in faith. For that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you great reward. So accepting the invitation, taking whatever they give you, it's akhlaq and morals of believing men and women of Islam. So let us learn to say yes and no to no thanks, if that makes any sense. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
In this night of destiny, which is better than a thousand months, dear Lord, we beseech you to shape our destiny in the most excellent manner.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La la la.
We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of fasting and the month of Ramadan and some of the questions and answers related to it based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, some people have problems with their gums. And it's always bleeding the mouth. They got a problem with it. So sometimes blood gets mixed up with their saliva. Sometimes they're not sure whether this is saliva that enters the throat or which one is mixed with blood or not. So what's the rule about their fasting? Is their fasting valid? Are they supposed to, like, fast at all based on the jurisprudence?
That's a very good question. If the blood from your gums, let's say, dissolves in the saliva and it disappears in the sense that there's no traces or there are no traces of blood seen in the saliva, it's just as white as saliva itself, and not red in the form of blood. You know, so it is kind of that in Arabic word they call it istihlak. So it has disappeared. The blood has disappeared in the saliva, mm-hmm. So it's pure. And of course, there's no problem in swallowing it, and allowing the saliva to get into your throat. And of course, in this case, the fast is not made invalid. And in the event, because sometimes you are not able to check your saliva whether there is blood less, whether the blood has disappeared or not. Or whether there are any traces of blood available in the saliva or not. So, if you are not sure that the blood is mixed with it or not, so in this case, it can be of course swallowed. It will not affect the fast because you are not sure.
Mm-hmm, I see. Another problem that some people may experience is that, usually it's always recommended actually for individuals who are fasting to brush their teeth, but sometimes they forget, all right?
Yeah.
And there may remain some bits of food in their mouth between their teeth, and some of these bits of food may be unintentionally swallowed.
Yes.
All right? If that happens, in that scenario, what happens to the fasting? Is their fast void? And if it is invalidated, should they perform the qada?
Well, if you did not know that some particles of food or bits of food remained between the teeth, or you did not know that they would reach the throat, and of course, you knew that there were some particles, there were some bits of food left in the mouth, but you did not know that they would reach the throat, and mm-hmm. of course. But, and finally they were swallowed unknowingly or unintentionally, and then, of course, then you are not liable to make qada of the fast. You see, there's nothing on you, and you should assume that your fast is valid. Because you did not swallow it deliberately and intentionally or knowingly, something happened without you intending it. So you are not to blame, and you are not liable for any qaza either.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back with more questions related to your jurisprudence of fasting and Ramadan. So stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. This is Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and Ramadan based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, I know that I've asked you this question a couple of times before related to fasting and Ramadan. When we were talking about swimming, all right, and you said, I remember that, it's okay if you have, some parts of your body in the water, but you can't dip the head.
Sure.
Right? So dip in the head, that's all over. Your fast is rendered void.
Yes.
But the thing is, what about pouring some water over your head? Sometimes people become so thirsty and they take a shower or something like that, and or they pour some water over their head. Of course, they don't dip their head in the water like the swimming pool.
Yes.
But is that allowed? Like, is it permissible for those people to fast?
Yeah, I think I shouldn't say I think, because it's something that I should quote and should actually cite the Risala or the treatise of His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei. He has stated clearly that pouring water on one's head with a jug full of water actually is it does not affect the one's fasting. And so it's not considered immersing one's head. What, according to his opinion, immersing one's head underwater or submerging underwater makes the fast void. But in this scenario, of course, pouring water, even though the quantity of water is it might be too much, since it's not considered in common view, it's not considered to be immersing underwater, immersing one's head underwater. So it's not going to affect fasting. So you are allowed. So it's just like going to taking a shower and then standing under the shower and washing your head and neck and then the body, because you pour the pressure of the water, you feel that there's too much water coming down on your head. So it does not, absolutely it does not affect your fast, and there's no objection to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Another question would be related to the women's diseases. There are certain medicines or drugs that are applied through the vagina. There are some suppositories that are usually, used through the anus of some people to prevent, for example, from fever. So the question is that does this kind of, or the use of this kind of medicine or drug invalidate fasting?
Well, the use of such medicine does not invalidate the fast. If a person, there is a difference, or there are different scenarios. Suppositories are supposed to be hard things, or mm-hmm. Inserted in the patient's anus, to bring down or to reduce the fever. But if, let's say, fluid is inserted, and it's called emala in Arabic, of course, if fluid is inserted in the back passage, of course, it will definitely have effect. It will make the fast void, because fluids make this.
But non-fluids?
Speaking, non-fluids do not have any effect on the individual's fasting.
So their fasting is okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chobit, for your nice comments. The program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which I try to ask some of the questions, especially in these series of episodes, related to the month of Ramadan and the questions related to fasting. And please, I earnestly ask you to pray for us, especially in this blessed month of Ramadan. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Thank you. light fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Reacting to a threat-riddled speech by the Israeli Prime Minister, Hamas Resistance Movement said Benjamin Netanyahu's remarks will not weaken Palestinians' resolve to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque against the occupying regime's aggression.
Netanyahu's speech cannot frighten our Palestinian people. Palestinians will continue the battle to defend the identity of Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of the religious war waged by the enemy.
Qassem's remarks came as the Tel Aviv regime has been dangerously stoking tensions throughout the occupied territories and beyond when it carried out a savage attack on Palestinian worshippers who were observing the holy fasting month of Ramadan at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, which is Islam's third holiest site. The first bout of the raid saw the regime's forces storming the compound, beating the Palestinian worshippers there before arresting and forcing out hundreds of them. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded as a result of the violence. The raids prompted several rounds of retaliatory rocket strikes against the occupied territories from the direction of the Gaza Strip, where Hamas is headquartered, as well as from Lebanon and Syria. During his Monday speech, Netanyahu admitted that the regime has responded to retaliatory strikes by dropping 50 tons of bombs on ground targets belonging to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. He also accused Hamas of being behind the reprisal attacks that targeted the occupied territories from Lebanon, saying, "We will not allow Hamas to establish itself in Lebanon by acting on all fronts." The Israeli premier also claimed that the regime had thwarted hundreds of operations in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year, alleging that the regime could reach the resistance everywhere. Responding to Netanyahu's claims, Qassem described his speech as an attempt to falsify the facts, saying that the Israeli occupation was the basis of all tensions across the occupied territories. The Hamas official said the occupiers are the ones who practice terrorism systematically and continuously, pointing out that the Palestinian people are waging a legitimate battle to restore their right to freedom and independence. He added that Netanyahu's threats against our Palestinian people, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran prove that the occupying regime is a menace to the entire region and its interests. The Israeli army was taken aback by the allegations of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who said on April 10th that attacks on Lebanon last week targeted Hezbollah positions. The Israeli premier said during a news conference on Monday that in the attacks on Lebanon, in addition to the positions of Hamas, we also targeted the positions of Hezbollah in Lebanon. According to Yossi Yehoshua, the military affairs commentator for an Israeli daily, the army was very surprised to hear Netanyahu say that Hezbollah's infrastructure was attacked in Lebanon, as Tel Aviv took great care to only hit alleged Hamas targets. Netanyahu's sham allegation came during a press conference in which he also backpedaled on his decision to sack his minister Yoav Gallant. The embattled premier said, "I've decided to put our differences behind us." Earlier in his speech, Netanyahu took aim at the opposition led by former Prime Minister Yair Lapid, blaming him for the multiple crises gripping Israel. Netanyahu accused Lapid and his officials of showing weakness. In particular, the premier pointed to the maritime demarcation deal signed with the Lebanese government last year under U.S. mediation, claiming that the agreement had instead been signed with Hezbollah without getting anything in return. Netanyahu also blasted Israeli citizens and army reservists who took to the streets to protest against his judicial overhaul plan, saying, "When you declare that Israel is collapsing, How do you think our enemies interpret this? Monday's speech came just hours after Israeli media released poll results showing that support for Netanyahu's Likud party has nosedived. According to the survey, more than two-thirds of voters disapproved of Netanyahu's performance in office. If elections were held today, Likud would lose more than a third of its seats in the Knesset.
Into the Saudi war on Yemen, there are hopes that the prolonged conflict may be coming to an end. Delegations from Saudi Arabia and Oman have arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to hold talks with leaders of the Ansar Allah movement. Upon arrival, the delegations met with senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi. The delegations have also met with head of the council, Mahdi al-Mash'at. According to a diplomat, the Saudi delegation, headed by their ambassador to Yemen, Mohammed Said al-Jaber, is in Sana'a to discuss moving forward to create peace in Yemen. Yemeni media say the Saudis are going to negotiate the removal of tight naval and air blockade on Yemen and an end to the eight-year-long aggression, restoration of the Yemeni nation's rights, and the payment of civil servants' salaries as well as portion of oil and gas revenues during negotiations. A Yemeni source said the Saudis and Houthis had agreed in principle on a six-month truce to pave the way for talks on establishing for the war-torn nation. The presence of Saudi and Omani delegations in Yemen was hailed by the Ansar Allah movement. Senior Ansar Allah member Muhammad al-Bukhaiti said achieving an honorable peace between the Houthis and Saudi Arabia would be a triumph for both sides. Bukhaiti has urged all sides to take steps to preserve a peaceful atmosphere and prepare to turn the page of the past. Inside Yemen, people express hope that the negotiations would produce favorable results.
We hope for the best and we hope that these negotiations can lead the people to safety.
The talks also drew positive reactions from the United Nations. UN Envoy for Yemen Hans Grundberg described the ongoing efforts, including the Saudi and Omani talks in Sana'a, as the closest Yemen has been to real progress towards lasting peace since the war began. He said this is a moment to be seized and built on, and a real opportunity to start an inclusive political process under UN auspices to sustainably end the conflict. Peace talks in Yemen come years after the Saudi government launched a devastating war on the Arab country, hoping it would win in less than a month. The aim of that war was to crush the Ansar Allah movement and reinstate former Yemeni President Abdel Rabbu Mansour Hadi to power. Riyadh has used most sophisticated weapons purchased from the United States and the United Kingdom against the Yemeni people, along with a land, air, and sea blockade on the country. The conflict, however, has stopped well shy of its goals, despite turning the entire country into the scenes of what the United Nations termed as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. According to UN figures, hundreds of thousands of people have so far been killed and millions of others displaced. The war also destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure, leaving millions of people across the country in desperate need of vital necessities. The peace talks also come on the backdrop of a recent China-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia to normalize relations. The negotiations aimed at bringing an end to the Yemen conflict are indications of a number of things. First and foremost, the talks show that the war has brought Saudis to an utter exhaustion. After all, putting all that fun and Western tactical support for Riyadh should get them somewhere. The war on Yemen did not. Secondly, the Saudis have come to realize that Western prescription for their war on Yemen is not working. On the contrary, they have come to the understanding that establishing regional peace lies in the reunification of nations in West Asia. Maybe that's why they decided to end hostilities with Tehran and normalize their relations with the Islamic Republic. All what it seems that with Saudi authorities trying to distance themselves from the United States and its warmongering policies, the West Asia region can be a place where countries can coexist, having strong brotherly ties. Tensions between Washington and Beijing are now entering a rather dangerous phase. China has launched military drills around Taiwan in what it called a stern warning to the self-ruled island. Dubbed United Sharp Sword, the three-day exercise would send planes, ships, and personnel into the maritime areas and airspace of the Taiwan Strait, off the northern and southern coasts of the island, and to the island's east. Chinese military said the drills, which will run until Monday, are rehearsing an encirclement of Taiwan. They say the type of weaponry China will use during the drills will include long-range rocket artillery, naval destroyers, missile boats, Air Force fighters, and bombers. Beijing says the aim of the drills is to deter provocations from the United States. In a statement, China's People's Liberation Army said these operations serve as a stern warning against a collusion between separatist forces seeking Taiwan independence and against their provocative activities. It says the operations are necessary for safeguarding China's national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The maneuvers will include live-fire drills off the coast of China's Fujian province, which faces Taiwan. The exercises came on the heels of the provocative meeting held in the U.S. state of California between Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen and U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That enraged China, which regards self-ruled Taiwan as part of its own territory and has vowed to eventually take it over by force if necessary. The three-day-long drills have immensely angered Taiwan. President Tsai denounced the maneuvers, pledging to work with the U.S. and its allies in the face of what she called continued authoritarian expansionism. Taiwan's defense ministry slammed China for conducting the drills, calling the decision irrational. It said China was using Tsai's U.S. visit as an excuse to conduct military exercises, noting that the drills have seriously undermined peace, stability, and security in the region. Drills by China comes as a delegation of U.S. legislators, led by Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Michael McCaul, is currently visiting Taiwan and has met with Taiwanese leader Tsai. McCaul said the delegation was in Taipei to show its support for the democratic island. Speaking at an event in Taiwan, McCaul underlined that the visit was intended to demonstrate strong support for the self-ruled Taiwan.
And as the House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman, I sign off on all foreign military sales, including weapons to Taiwan. And I promise you, Madam President, we will deliver those weapons.
McCaul's trip to Taiwan is not the first such visit by a U.S. official to the self-ruled island. Back in August, then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan along with a delegation of Democratic Party members of the House to reaffirm Washington's support to Taiwan. Apart from Pelosi, some other high-ranking U.S. officials have for a number of times thrown Washington's all-out support for Taiwan. Among them, U.S. President Joe Biden. He has given his strongest saying Washington is committed to defending Taiwan's military in the event of an attack from China. But what if China tries to take Taiwan? And in such a scenario, are the United States and its allies able to stop it? While Beijing warns that the self-ruled island is an inseparable part of China and that the future of Taiwan lies in the reunification with the motherland, what objectives is the United States seeking other than provocation? The bigger question will be, would the United States bear with the same thing if China was to station its forces and fleets around Central and Latin America or anywhere near U.S. borders? Although it's crystal clear that the security of Taiwan has the potential to be used as a political tool by the U.S. and NATO against Beijing, but a more dangerous scenario is that Taiwan could be used as a reason for conflict between the West and China, much like what is happening in Ukraine between the West and Russia these days. As long as China continues to push its global economic goals, such as its Belt and Road Initiative, in addition to investment to boost its military capabilities, Taiwan will remain on the list of the West's most intractable problems. But the fact is that the United States is provoking China over Taiwan at a cost no one would ever want to imagine.
prayers in front of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ramadan is supposed to be a time of peace and reflection, but in the occupied territories, the Zionist regime does not think so. Israeli forces raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Worshippers said they were attacked violently.
I was praying and I was sitting on a chair reciting the Quran. They heard stun grenades. One of them hit my chest. Now my family will see me and they will feel terrible.
Western media depict another version. They reported that there were clashes inside the mosque. Do these scenes look like clashes? You could hear the muffled sound of Israeli forces' batons beating on the flesh of Palestinian worshippers. Worshippers who should be allowed to pray, but are instead beaten.
They attacked us inside there. All the young people inside are suffering and no one is helping them. What are you waiting for? They attacked everyone inside. The windows of the mosque are all God is great.
Tensions have remained high in occupied Palestine. So far this year, around 100 Palestinians have been killed. On Thursday, there were rocket attacks from the resistance forces out of Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. Israel retaliated on both territories, interestingly blaming Hamas for both, and not Hezbollah, who said it stood ready anyways to defend the Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, a car ramming attack occurred in Tel Aviv, happening hours after two Israeli settlers were killed in a shooting. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remained defiant. World condemnations and protests have followed, with Hamas slamming the Israeli violence. Al-Aqsa Mosque has long been a flashpoint between Palestinians and Israelis over matters of sovereignty and religion in Al-Quds. Under the long-standing status quo arrangement, non-Muslims can visit, but only Muslims are allowed to worship in the mosque. Yet Israel has acted against this, especially when it comes to extreme settlers. The most provocative Israeli incident at Al-Aqsa Mosque came on the 28th of September 2000, when then-Israeli opposition leader Ariel Sharon entered the courtyard, escorted by over 1,000 Israeli police officers, and declared it would forever remain under Israel's control. That led to the Second Intifada, which resulted in the deaths of more than 3,000 Palestinians and more than 1,000 Israelis over a period of 5 years. That sentiment is now carried by the extreme cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, led by Itamar Ben-Gvir. Israel's extreme minister entered the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds in January in a move Palestinians called a dislocation. In the most recent rocket fire from the Gaza Strip and Lebanon, which he blamed Hamas for, Itamar Ben-Gvir said, "Hamas rockets require more than blasting dunes and empty sites. It's time to rip heads off in Gaza. We must not deviate from an equation that necessitates a serious response for each and every rocket." Let's not forget, Ben-Gvir has been convicted for racist incitement against Arabs and support for terrorism. He has also expressed support for Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli-American who killed 29 Palestinians at the Ibrahimi Mosque in 1994. His wife, Ayala Ben-Gvir, has encouraged every Israeli citizen who can hold a weapon to hold it to save his life. That's code for killing Palestinians. The Palestinians, on the other hand, have intensified their resistance, with groups in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank becoming more united that resistance is the only way to confront the Israeli regime.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barat.
Peace be upon you,
O Abba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence was the 9th divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. We find many proofs for the great treasure of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the great proofs of the great treasure of knowledge and wisdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that while His Eminence was still in his tender youth, the Shia jurisprudence, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, hastened towards the city of Medina. They came to inquire as to know who is the next infallible and divinely appointed Imam. The reliable people and those who were trustworthy guided these Shia jurisprudents who had come from different places in the Islamic world towards Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. The Shia jurisprudents went to Imam al-Jawad and asked His Eminence the most ambiguous and complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Dear friends, we live in an age where we find that injustice and oppression has taken up practically every corner of the world. Now, on a negative side, of course, nobody likes injustice and nobody likes oppression, whether it is on a dual societal or even global level. But on a positive side, of course, before the advent of the Imam of the time, may Allah hasten his reappearance, Imam al-Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif, we find that oppression and injustice, of course, will take over practically every corner of the earth, and it is precisely because of this that the divinely appointed Imam alayhi salam returns and brings justice and truth to a world which is full of oppression and injustice. Now, normally we think that injustice is only perpetrated by the individual committing the unjust act. But we find that in a conversation between Imam Jawad alayhi salam and his companions, they were asking about, you know, the governmental establishments and how they are the ones that are committing all the injustice. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam here says something very interesting in this dialogue and in these conversations. And he said that the doer of injustice, the supporter of the injustice, and the one who agrees to the injustice are all participants in it. So we learn from this dialogue and this conversation of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam with his companions that just the individual who is doing the oppression or the injustice, that one individual or that one entity is not the only one to blame. There are other people to blame as well, and the first of the other is the person who supports that injustice, a person who supports that oppression, whether it be financial support or material support or mental, psychological support, physical support, a moral support. These are all kind of supports and in ways that people can aid other people. And in this situation, Imam al-Jawad is saying that a person who supports the injustice and supports the oppression and the oppressor and the unjust, as well as the person who agrees on this injustice, most probably the word that is used in Arabic is radhi. Now, radhi is sometimes, I mean, it can be translated into agreeing with, being satisfied with, being content with, but it is also, at times, it can be translated into complacency, to be at ease with or to be complacent with something. And so here, one who agrees with it, the injustice and the oppression, as well as the person who supports the injustice and the oppression, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says that they're all participants in it. So dear friends, in the present day, we must make sure that not only do we not side with the unjust and the oppressor and the tyrant and the dictators and etc., but we must also make sure not to support them in any way, whether it is financial or moral or spiritual or physical or mental or whatever, material. In no way can we support the people that are unjust and the entities that are unjust. And finally, we cannot agree or be complacent with what they are doing, which is in reality breaking the commandments of the Almighty Allah. So just remember that the doer of injustice, the supporter of injustice, and the one who agrees upon the injustice are all participants in that injustice. And of course, this oppression and injustice is something that Allah the Almighty will take one a hold of. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
السلام عليك أيها النور الصافي السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالب السلام
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Thank you.
this night of providence, when the gates of heaven open up for all of God's servants, we raise our hands towards the heavens and earnestly beseech the Almighty to hear our voices. O Lord, you hear everything and you have infinite power.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned. What happens if Allah does not give us His blessings anymore? Prophet Muhammad, in a beautiful hadith, states, the value of a blessing is recognized when that blessing is missed. Prophet Moses asked Allah what to do so that people pay more attention to Allah. Allah answered Moses, enumerate for them my blessings. Now, how much are we careful, for example, about our eyes, a piece of fat with which we can see?
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam ba un tabib hindi.
In a dialogue between Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and the Indian physician, the Imam asked him, do you know why the tear tastes salty? The Indian physician couldn't answer. Imam Sadiq alayhi, because the main tissue of the eye is made of fat. Allah has put it in a salty liquid, because without such a liquid, your fat of eye will be rotten in a day. This is how Allah gives us His blessings, and we must be more attentive to abide by His rulings. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
in the limelight. Although Benjamin Netanyahu has postponed the approval of judicial reforms due to fear of widespread protests and opposition, the protests in the occupied territories against his controversial plan continue. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. Tens of thousands of Israelis joined protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plans to overhaul the judiciary, despite soaring tensions after two deadly attacks a day earlier. The protests against the plans, which were paused last month in the face of a wave of strikes and mass demonstrations, come amid surging violence in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Palestinian Health Ministry said as protesters rallied in Tel Aviv on Saturday, 8th of April, Israeli forces shot and martyred a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Ahed Salim, a 20-year-old Palestinian, was hit in the chest and stomach by live rounds used by Israeli soldiers near Qalqilya in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, more than 1,500 Israeli settlers broke into the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Mosque through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, and toured it under the protection of the regime's forces. Militant Israeli settlers also provocatively performed rituals in the sacred site. Media reports said the occupation forces had earlier stormed the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque and removed the Palestinian worshippers from the holy site to pave the way for the militant settlers' incursions. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly stormed the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Such mass settler break-ins almost always take place at the behest of the Tel Aviv-backed temple groups and under the auspices of the Israeli police,